And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I've been reading now for a little over a month. That also happens to be the 2024 Newbery Award-winning book titled The Eyes and the Impossible. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book about an elephant titled Soon. And then it's Library Lion, A Perfect Father's Day. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with some Shel Silverstein poems from his book titled Everything on It. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Soon. Very early one morning, Raju and his mother set out on a great adventure. It was cold and dark. They walked for a long time. When can we go home again? Asked Raju. Soon, said his mother. And both Raju and his mother are elephants. They came to the river where the crocodiles dozed. We must be very quiet, says Raju's mother. But the crocodiles heard them anyway and came snapping. Raju's mother stamped her feet so hard it made the ground tremble. And the crocodiles went scrambling off into the water. When can we go home again? Asked Raju. Soon, said his mother. They came to the forest where the snake sleeps. We must be very quiet, said Raju's mother. But the snake heard them anyway and came slithering. Raju's mother blew her trunk so hard it made the trees shake. And the snake went sliding off into the shadows. When can we go home again? Asked Raju. Soon, said his mother. They came to the tall grass where the tiger prowled. We must be very quiet, said Raju's mother. But the tiger heard them anyway and came roaring. Raju's mother reared up so high she was as big as a giant. And the tiger went running off into the tall grass. When can we go home again? Asked Raju. Soon, said his mother. Then they came to the mountain. We're going to climb it, said Raju's mother. Hold on tight to my tail. At last they reached the top of the mountain. Raju could see all his world spread out before him. It's beautiful, isn't it? Said Raju's mother. Yes, said Raju. They were very quiet. When can we go home again? Asked Raju. His mother smiled and stroked his head with her trunk. Now, she said. And they walked all the way back down the mountain, past the tiger in the tall grass, past the snake in the forest, past the crocodiles by the river, to their cozy little home. Did you enjoy our great adventure? Asked Raju's mother. Raju was tired and his feet hurt, and he had never been up so late in his life before. When can we do it all again? Raju asked. Soon, said his mother. Library Lion. One day, a lion came to the library. He walked right past the circulation desk and up into the stacks. Mr. McBee ran down the hall to the head librarian's office. Miss Merriweather, he called. No running, said Miss Merriweather, without looking up. But there's a lion, said Mr. McBee. In the library. Is he breaking any rules? Asked Miss Merriweather. She was very particular about rule breaking. Well, no, said Mr. McBee, not really. Then leave him be. The lion wandered all around the library. He sniffed the card catalog. He rubbed his head against the new book collection. Then he padded over to the story corner and went to sleep. No one was sure what to do. There weren't any rules about lions in the library. Soon it was time for story hour. There weren't any rules about lions at story hour either. The story lady seemed a little nervous, but she read out the first book's title in a good, clear voice. The lion looked up. The story lady kept reading. The lion stayed for the next story, and the story after that. He waited for another story, but the children began to walk away. "Story hour is over," a little girl told him. "It's time to go." The lion looked at the children. He looked at the story lady. He looked at the closed books. Then he roared very loud. "Roar!" Miss Merriweather came striding out of her office. "Who is making that noise?" she demanded. "It's the lion," said Mr. McBee. Miss Merriweather marched over to the lion. "If you cannot be quiet, you will have to leave," she said in a stern voice. "Those are the rules." The lion kept roaring. He sounded sad. The little girl tugged on Miss Merriweather's dress. "If he promises to be quiet, can he come back for story hour tomorrow?" she asked. The lion stopped roaring. He looked at Miss Merriweather. Miss Merriweather looked back. Then she said, "Yes, a nice, quiet lion would certainly be allowed to come back for story hour tomorrow." "Hooray!" said the children. The next day, the lion came back. "You are early," said Miss Merriweather. "Story hour is not until 3 o'clock. The lion did not budge. "Very well," said Miss Merriweather. "You might as well make yourself useful." She sent him off to dust the encyclopedias until it was time for story hour. The next day, the lion came early again. This time, Miss Merriweather asked him to lick all the envelopes for the overdue notices. Soon, the lion began doing things without being asked. He dusted the encyclopedias. He licked the envelopes. He let small children stand on his back to reach books on the highest shelves. Then he curled up in the story corner to wait for story hour to begin. At first, the people in the library were nervous about the lion, but soon they got used to having him around. In fact, he seemed very well suited for the library. His big feet were quiet on the library floor. He made a comfy backrest for the children at story hour, and he never roared in the library anymore. "What a helpful lion," people said. They patted his soft head as he walked by. "How did we ever get along without him?" Mr. McBee scowled when he heard that. They had always gotten along fine before. No lions were needed. Lions, he thought, could not understand rules. They did not belong in the library. One day, after he had dusted all the encyclopedias and licked all the envelopes and helped all the small children, the lion padded down the hall to Miss Merriweather's office to see what else there was to do. There was still some time left before story hour. "Hello, lion," said Miss Merriweather. "I know something you can do. You can bring a book back into the stacks for me. Let me just get it down from the shelf." Miss Merriweather stepped up onto the step stool. The book was just out of reach. Miss Merriweather stood on her toes. She stretched out her fingers. "Almost there," she said. Then Miss Merriweather stretched a little too far. "Ouch," said Miss Merriweather softly. She did not get up. "Mr. McBee," she called after a minute. "Mr. McBee." But Mr. McBee was at the circulation desk. He could not hear her calling. "Lion," said Miss Merriweather, "please go and get Mr. McBee." The lion ran down the hall. "No running," Miss Merriweather called after him. The lion put his big front paws up on the circulation desk and looked at Mr. McBee. "Go away, lion," said Mr. McBee. "I'm busy." The lion whined. He pointed his nose down the hall toward Miss Merriweather's office. Mr. McBee ignored him. Finally, the lion did the only thing he could think of to do. He looked Mr. McBee right in the eye. Then he opened his mouth very wide, and he roared the loudest roar he had ever roared in his life. "Roar!" Mr. McBee gasped. "You're not being quiet," he said to the lion. "You're breaking the rules." Mr. McBee walked down the hall as fast as he could. The lion did not follow him. He had broken the rules. He knew what that meant. He hung his head and walked toward the doors. Mr. McBee did not notice. "Miss Merriweather," he called as he walked. "Miss Merriweather, the lion broke the rules. The lion broke the rules." He burst into Miss Merriweather's office. She was not in her chair. "Miss Merriweather?" he asked. "Sometimes," said Miss Merriweather from the floor behind her desk, "there's a good reason to break the rules, even in the library. Now please go call a doctor. I think I've broken my arm." Mr. McBee ran to call a doctor. "No running," Miss Merriweather called after him. The next day, things were back to normal. Almost. Miss Merriweather's left arm was in a cast. The doctor had told her not to work too hard. "I will have my lion to help me," Miss Merriweather thought. But the lion did not come to the library that morning. At 3 o'clock, Miss Merriweather walked over to the story corner. The story lady was just beginning a story for the children. The lion was not there. People in the library kept looking up from their books and computer screens, hoping they would see a familiar, furry face. But the lion did not come that day. The lion did not come the next day, either, or the day after that. One evening, Mr. McBee stopped by Miss Merriweather's office on his way out. "Can I do anything for you before I go, Miss Merriweather?" he asked her. "No, thank you," said Miss Merriweather. She was looking out the window. Her voice was very quiet, even for the library. Mr. McBee frowned as he walked away. He thought there probably was something he could do for Miss Merriweather, after all. Mr. McBee left the library, but he did not go home. He walked around the neighborhood. He looked under cars. He looked behind bushes. He looked in backyards and trash cans and tree houses. Finally, he circled all the way back to the library. The lion was sitting outside, looking in through the glass doors. "Hello, lion," said Mr. McBee. The lion did not turn around. "I thought you might like to know," said Mr. McBee, "that there's a new rule at the library. No roaring allowed, unless you have a very good reason. Say, if you're trying to help a friend who's been hurt, for example." The lion's ears twitched. He turned around. But Mr. McBee was already walking away. The next day, Mr. McBee walked down the hall to Miss Merriweather's office. "What is it, Mr. McBee?" asked Miss Merriweather in her new, sad, quiet voice. "I thought you might like to know," said Mr. McBee, "that there's a lion in the library." Miss Merriweather jumped up from her chair and ran down the hall. Mr. McBee smiled. "No running," he called after her. Miss Merriweather didn't listen. Sometimes there was a good reason to break the rules, even in the library. A perfect Father's Day. So it shows a man sitting in his lounge chair reading a newspaper, and a cat just jumped up on his lap. And there's a little girl behind a chair. "Who's there?" "It's Susie, and I'm taking you out for a perfect Father's Day," Susie said. "First, we'll go for lunch." "Good," Dad said. "May I drive?" "Certainly," Susie said. "Have a good time," Mom called as they waved goodbye. Susie chose where they'd eat. "This is your favorite food, isn't it, Dad?" she asked. "Sure is," Dad said. "May I pay?" "Certainly," Susie said. "I think we'll go to the duck pond after lunch," Susie said. "You like to feed the ducks, don't you, Dad?" "Sure do," Dad said. "May I buy the duck food?" "Certainly," Susie said, "and I think we'll go to the park after that." "You like the park, don't you, Dad?" "Of course," Dad said. And it shows them now on a swing. "Do you like the swings?" Susie asked. "Do you like the monkey bars?" And it shows him trying to climb the monkey bars. "Do you like the merry-go-round?" "The giraffe's the best. I like them all," Dad said. "Do you want a balloon, Dad?" Susie asked. "Red balloons are my favorite." Dad bought a red one for Susie and a blue one to bring home to Mom. "Are you having a good Father's Day so far?" Susie asked. Dad smiled. "Perfect. But I think we should go home now. Mom will be waiting." "Will you hold the balloons while I drive?" "Certainly," Susie said. Dad closed the car windows so the balloons wouldn't float away. And so Susie wouldn't float away either. "Mom has a special cake for you," Susie whispered. "It's chocolate with chocolate frosting and yellow writing. And it says, Happy Father's Day. And there are 4 yellow candles, one for every year you've been my dad. It's a surprise." "I like surprises," Dad said. Mom was wearing her prettiest t-shirt, the one with the sparkles that Dad liked. Their prettiest cloth was on the table. So was the cake. Dad gave Mom a kiss and the blue balloon. "My goodness," he said. "That cake's chocolate, and it has chocolate frosting and yellow writing, and it says, Happy Father's Day. And there are 4 yellow candles, one for every year I've been Susie's dad. What a surprise!" "Dad likes surprises," Susie told Mom. "I like chocolate, too," Dad said, and he blew out the candles and cut a big piece of cake for each of them. "We did all Dad's favorite things and went to all his favorite places," Susie told Mom. "It has been a perfect Father's Day so far." "Perfect," Dad said. "May I have a hug?" "Certainly," Susie said. And I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with some Shel Silverstein poems from his book, Everything on It. "Don't change on my account. If you're sloppy, that's just fine. If you're moody, I won't mind. If you're fat, that's fine with me. If you're skinny, let it be. If you're bossy, that's all right. If you're nasty, I won't fight. If you're rough, well, that's just you. If you're mean, that's all right too. Whatever you are is all okay. I don't like you anyway." dirty clothes. Some put them in a washer. Some toss them in a tub. Some dump them in a laundry truck. For some, someone else to scrub. Some stick them in a hamper. Some stuff them in a sack. I never worry about them. I just keep them on my back. Dumb. The dumbest thing that any kid could ever do, I did. Rude Rudy Reese. Rude Rudy Reese. Rude Rudy Reese. He never said thank you and never said please. He'd yell, "Give me a quarter," or "Cook me some peas," or "Pass me the salt." But he never said please. One day, down the mountain, he came on his skis, yelling, "Clear me a path." But he never said please. So he bounced off the rocks and got caught in the trees, yelling, "Help get me down." But he didn't say please. So he tried climbing down, but he slipped on some leaves, yelling, "Catch me, someone." But he didn't say please. So he fell in some poo right up to his knees, yelling, "Quick, pull me out." But he didn't say please. Then he got attacked by some low-flying geese. We'd have shooed him away, but he didn't say please. So he sunk to his chin. Then along came some bees. He screamed, "Throw me a rope," but he didn't say please. Then along came a reptile from out of the seas. He thought, "Lord, save me now," but he didn't think please. So the reptile ate him with crackers and cheese. We'd have passed him the salt, but he didn't say please. New job. Just 2 hours working in the candy store, and I don't like candy anymore. The dollhouse. You can't crawl back in the dollhouse. You've gotten too big to get in. You've got to live here like the rest of us do. You've got to walk roads that are winding and new. But oh, I wish I could crawl back with you into the dollhouse again. You'll never be king. "You'll never be king," said the queen to the prince, "if you keep on misplacing your crown. And you twirl your scepter just like a baton. And you walk through the halls upside down." "He'll never be king," said the duke to the earl, "for he plays with his toes on the throne. And he wiggles and giggles and rolls in the mud. And he likes to go walking alone." "Oh, I shall be a king," said the prince to himself, "and my people shall all learn to sing and play in the sand and walk in their hands and have as much fun as their king." Going up, going down. A skinny, hungry alligator got in a crowded elevator. The doors slid shut, and 6 floors later, a fat and burping alligator got off an empty elevator. Italian food. Oh, how I love Italian food. I eat it all the time, not just 'cause how good it tastes, but 'cause how good it rhymes. Minestrone, cannelloni, macaroni, rigatoni, spaghetti, scallopini, escaroli, braccaroli, insalata, cremolata, manicotti, marinara, carbonara, shrimp fricassee, bolognese, ravioli, mosticoccoli, mozzarella, tanguinella, fried zucchini, rollatini, fettuccine, green linguine, tortellini, testarani. Oops, I think I split my Genie. Looking for Santa. They told me once, and I didn't believe, you won't see him coming. You won't see him leave. So, I'll tell you once, and you'd better believe, don't look up the chimney on Christmas Eve. Stick a tongue out, Sid. Did you hear about stick a tongue out, Sid? He stuck out his tongue at all the kids. He stuck it out at recess, and then, at lunch, he stuck it out again. School days, he stuck it out at his teachers. Sundays, he stuck it out at the preacher. Saturdays, he stuck it out at a double feature. But one day, he stuck it out at Helen McHatter, a girl who didn't like tongues stuck out at her. She grabbed that tongue. She pulled it hard. She rolled it out about 20 yards and danced around and round and round and round and round. That tongue unwound around his head, around his chin, around his neck and back again. She wound it once around his eyes, around his ears. She wound it twice. Around his face, she wrapped it light. Around his waist, she wrapped it tight. Around his back, around his seat, around his legs, around his feet, until he stood there all entwined, with no more tongue left to unwind. And now, stick a tongue out, Sid, really is a tongue-tied kid. Nasty school. Oh, have you heard of nasty school? They teach nasty things, and they have nasty rules. They only take nasties and rowdies and fools. So come, let's take a walk through nasty school. You get to nasty school through a secret gate. The first rule is you must be late. Your hands and face must be all caked with dirt. There must be lots of grease and gravy spots upon your shirt. In class, instead of listening, you just talk and make those awful squeaks upon the blackboard with your chalk. You must make sure your shoes are wet and muddy. And as for homework, you must guarantee you haven't studied. You must put gum on everybody's seat. And when there is a test, you have to promise that you'll cheat. Instead of teachers teaching you to make things, the bad school teachers teach you how to break things. They teach you how to smash a window pane and how to let a brand new bike get rusty in the rain, how to smash a vase to smithereens, how to tear the pages out of someone's magazine, how to hold your breath and spit and scream, how to put mustard into someone's chocolate chip ice cream, how to bang a fender full of dents, how to leave your footprint in a square of wet cement, how to pinch and punch and slam a door, how to splash water till you flood the bathroom floor, how to do some muddy belly flops, how to ruin your teeth with sugar pops, how to turn a dress into a rag, how to tear the bottom of a soggy garbage bag, how to bend your father's fishing hook, how to drip hot meatloaf gravy on your science book, how to fill a bathtub up with glue, how to bounce upon a bed until the springs pop through, how to fall out of an apple tree, how to scratch your toe and miss the toilet when you pee, how to spread a coat of honey on a volleyball, how to write your name in toothpaste on the bathroom wall, how to snap a shoelace when you tie it. These are all the things you'll learn in nasty school. Want to try it? For some schools, you can't just be good. You have to be the best. Here, you can't be rotten. You must be the rottenest. And this is just a reminder, my name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that was chosen as the best children's book in 2024, winning the Newbery Award, titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Johannes is a free dog, a fast dog, such a fast dog. He lives in an urban park by the sea, and every day he runs through the park, seeing all, missing nothing, and reporting what he sees to the park's three ancient bison, the keepers of the equilibrium. But the equilibrium has been disrupted. Mysterious rectangles are hypnotizing Johannes. The humans are erecting a mysterious new building, and an entirely new kind of animal has arrived in the park, and there are hundreds of them. Johannes must run faster, see better, and ultimately do more than run and see. He must liberate those he loves. Okay, last week, the animal's new plan is to somehow get Johannes into the new building being built inside the park. Just outside the park, Johannes ends up saving a baby that fell into a pond beside the new building. He dragged the baby to the shore where people took pictures and video of him rescuing her. Bertrand, the pelican, told him the girl survived. Johannes is now worried because everyone will be looking for him because he was the hero dog who saved the little girl who really just wants to be the eyes and remain free. And that's where I left off last week. Chapter 16. On top of all this, I had caught some kind of bug. I knew because the ducks liked it so much that the water in the pond was unclean. But ingesting it, oh, it was far worse to have swallowed that water. What I'd contracted, I didn't know, but it gave me the sneezes and halved my energy. I stayed in my hollow for the day and night after the rescue, and the day after that. Bertrand and I made a plan. To test the situation in the park, I would run as the eyes, and he would follow me from above. We would see which humans were out and about and might be watching for me. We would see if I could continue to be free. The sun was still rising above the trees when we set out, but immediately Johnson and Sharif, two of Angus's raccoon friends, stopped us. They were out of breath. "They're everywhere," they said. "Who?" Bertrand asked. "The humans," Johnson said. "There are parks people and parks police and some kind of other police and people with huge cameras. They're all over the place. You can't go out there." "They had one of those control the animals trucks," Sharif said. "It was big." Every so often, the control the animals people came to the park to take out an animal who had bitten a human, or an animal that was not where she or he was supposed to be. Yolanda was once pursued by the Control the Animals people when she had gone fishing in the peanut pond. It was a lesson to us all. Do not linger where you are not expected. Do not upset the humans' version of the equilibrium. Well, it did not mean that the turtles couldn't leave their pond, or that I couldn't converse with the bison. It meant only that being too obvious or showy about any of these unexpected appearances would bring the control the animals people, and they were not to be trifled with. They had cages and tranquilizer guns. I'd seen even the craftiest of the raccoons taken in minutes. The gun would be pointed. The gun would go pop, the tranquilizer would do its work, and the animal would be packed up in a cage and taken away. Where to? we never knew. "Let's just wait a day," Bertrand said. "The horses are sensing a storm later anyway." So I stayed in my hollow. I remained hidden and listened and looked and thought. I thought about the strangeness of salvation. I had saved the girl, and now I was a hostage in my own home. If I had allowed her to sink, or had simply watched and waited for someone else to save her, I would still be free. I would be able to run untethered, and she would probably be fine, saved by another. It seemed a clear truth that helping with anything or anyone at any time brought with it a unique kind of burden. Because I had always moved at the speed of light, I was unseen, and the unseen are uniquely free. But being slowed, stopping altogether, there were problems with this. I had been captured when I stopped to see the rectangles, and now I was hiding because I had stopped to save the girl. Stopping was a problem. Stopping meant captivity. Helping meant captivity. The wind outside picked up. But then again, I thought Bertrand and Yolanda and Sonia had helped me when I was a captive of the Trouble Travelers, and their interference returned my freedom to me. So that was an undeniable good, I thought. Maybe it's always complicated. No help is simple because no one being helped is simple. The notion that everything was complicated was itself sort of simple, and that made me smile. If we go through life assuming everything will be complicated, and then it is complicated, doesn't that make us better prepared? What I mean is, if we expect life to be complicated, and life is complicated, then life is simple, right? I needed to tell Bertrand this thought I had, this wonderful circular idea I had. I had a feeling he'd like it. Then the rain began. It began with dusty taps on the earth around my hollow. The dry brown dirt around me got wet and went black. I listened to the rain grow from taps to slaps to the hush of rain when it comes in teeming hordes. I decided I could wait to tell Bertrand my new idea. Rain is only rain, I thought drowsily. I slept on and off throughout the day and realized I was overtired. I needed rest. I needed this time alone with all this tiny water from the sky. I smelled the sweet eucalyptus on the wind. Such a sweet smell when mixed with fresh rain. Chapter 17. They say I slept for weeks. It seemed like years, centuries. I slept through days. I woke up in sunlight and woke up in moonlight and always spiraled back to sleep. My bones were tired. My muscles were tired. My skin, my fur, my eyes. I was tired of seeing, tired of doing. I dreamed and dreamed, but my dreams had no interpreter. Finally, one gray day, I woke, walked outside, and saw them all. Bertrand, Yolanda, Sonia, they were all standing outside my lair, as if waiting. "We've been waiting," Sonia said. "A while now, since sunup," said Yolanda. This meant a great deal, she implied. I didn't know what I was supposed to say. "What do you want me to say?" I said. "You've slept enough," Bertrand said. "No one needs that much sleep," Sonia said. "The point is, we care about you," Bertrand said. "The bison care about you and would like to see you. We'd all like to see you up and about and running and seen." "Even the ducks," said Yolanda. all of the people who didn't love or trust ducks, Yolanda was probably the most duck unloving and duck untrusting. So hearing her say this hit me hard. She cared about the ducks wanting to see me. It messed with my mind. The bison want you out there, Bertrand said. We've been picking up the slack, but not so well. They have been a bit snippy about it, to tell you the truth, Sonia said. They have so many questions, and even with all of us helping, we miss things. I began to feel better. Better because they had failed at that which I excelled. I was ashamed at my pride. Just then, the sun broke through the cloud cover and shone on me, warming me, loving my face, and I loved the sun back. I love you too, I said to the sun, because her love was so obvious and real. But everyone knows what you look like, Yolanda said. Though there are photos everywhere of you, Sonia said. Wild dog, they say, Yolanda said. Photos and little posters and even diagrams, Bertrand added. So you can't go out like yourself. I didn't understand. Maybe I'd been sleeping too long. I couldn't go out like myself. If you go out as yourself, they will know you as the hero dog, who is also a wild dog, and you will be leashed again, Yolanda said. And caged and kept, Sonia added. Probably sent away, Bertrand said softly. The sun had made me calm. The sun had made me wise. The sun had made me understand, instantly, the truth of what they said. I could not be seen in the park the way I had previously been seen. So we got you this, Yolanda said. With her beak, she presented me with a lump of bright pink. I had seen it, this lump, next to her this whole time. Now she, of all of them, were suggesting this pile of pink was somehow meant for me. What is it? I asked. I suddenly felt suffocated and surrounded, and this pile of pink was an affront, a smothering thing, I thought, a bolting. It's a disguise, Yolanda said. With her beak, she turned the pink pile into something recognizable, a sort of garment. It was tubular and made of wool with five gaps. One in the top left, one in the top right, one at the end, two on the bottom. And finally, it dawned on me that this was something I was supposed to wear. They saw the horror on my face. It's ridiculous, I know, Bertrand said. Obviously, it's terrible, but that's the point. This is what kept dogs wear, what pets wear. You will look like a silly pet of some silly human dressed in pink and wearing a collar. Sonia? Sonia now produced something far more offensive than the pink garment. It was a collar studded with bright plastic diamonds meant to be worn around the neck. It was an attack on all that was good and right. I can't wear that, I said. That or the pink tube. No. Then stay in your hollow, Sonia spat. Just stay and sleep and never come out again. I'd never seen Sonia so agitated. Why do we care if you never come out again? We don't care. No one cares. And she turned and ran off. Bertrand turned to the rest of the assistants. Can you excuse us a moment? He asked in that exhausted but wise way of his. The assistants all flew and scurried off, settling about 50 feet away. When they were out of earshot, Bertrand turned back to me. "We are concerned about you," he said. "Thank you," I said evenly. "I ask you to trust our collective wisdom," he said. "We have thought this through a great deal, and we have come to a series of related conclusions. Can I enumerate them?" I sighed. I looked down. I looked up to the sun. I breathed in. I breathed out. I did not like it when Bertrand took it upon himself to enumerate things. It tightened every bolt of my being. I took a deep breath. "Sure," I said. "First," he said, "you need to leave your hollow and be part of the world again. Second, you cannot leave your hollow looking like yourself. That is self-evident. Third, as you know, we have begun planning a way to get you into the museum to see the hundreds of rectangles that will no doubt please you greatly." This third item did get my attention, and Bertrand noticed. I smiled, picturing myself among the pictures inside that building. But then he looked at me with something like mischief, something like pity. "Lastly," he said, "we have devised a brilliant disguise. We, your friends." Because Bertrand is very smart, he knew he needed to dwell on this point, this mention of my friends who cared about me. If they had all gotten together and thought collectively about my well-being, about what would be best for me, how I could flaunt it, what monster would turn up his snout at the thought, though through help, of all the friends he had? "Okay," I said. "Okay, what?" he asked. "Okay, I'll try on the get-up," I said. My plan was to put it on, deem it ridiculous, and convince everyone else that it was ridiculous too. So Bertrand tossed me the pink garment and the sparkly collar, and I ducked my head into the sweater, and instantly I was stuck. The opening in at the neck was too narrow, so I was helpless inside, in the dark of the doggy sweater. "Help?" I asked from the darkness. Bertrand and Yolanda tried to help, but their beaks were imperfect tools for the job. They were pulling the woolen sweater apart. "Stop," I said. "If the sweater were a mess, the effect would be lost." A dog sweater, as demented and unnatural a thing as it was, must be pristine. We needed opposable thumbs. "We need Angus," I said. "He's sleeping," Yolanda said. "Wake him," I said, a bit too harshly. I realized how desperate I was to run again. "He'll understand." When Angus arrived, he was not happy. A nocturnal creature, he was halfway through his rest. I could not see him, given I was still stuck in the sweater, but I could hear his weariness in his voice. "The thing is," he said, "everyone's always got an emergency requiring opposable thumbs, and no one thinks it can wait until nighttime. But you know what? It can wait. It can always wait. Now, what's all this? What's that funny lump?" "That's Johannes," Yolanda said. "Why is he wearing a doggy sweater?" They explained it to him, and I tried to help explain, but Angus couldn't really understand me from under all that wool. Well, it's important to note that while Angus and all the other raccoons acted annoyed to be woken up and asked for help, they took great pride in their dexterity and cunning. They liked showing off their opposable thumbs and liked to complete any such mission in as little time as possible, as if to show how easy it was to do things that for the rest of us were impossible. "I'll get your paws through first," Angus said, and helped me disentangle my claws. He pulled one paw through and then the other. The head part is funny, he said. It's so thin, and your head is so big, he said, laughing. I wonder what kind of dog used to wear this. It must have had a tiny noggin. Can we get on with it, I ask. Did you say something, he asked. I can't understand you under all that sweater. The opening for my head was indeed very small. Angus had to pull on it from various sides, widening the gap. Try pushing through now, he said, and I tried. I made no progress. You must have some pit bull in you, he said. Only pit bulls have such huge heads. Angus had Yolanda grab one side of the sweater, and Bertrand grabbed another side, and Angus pulled himself, and we heard a tiny ripping sound. Oh, no, Yolanda said. Don't worry. We're just stretching it, Angus said. They continued stretching until Angus was satisfied. Try again now, he said, and I pushed, and with my snout, I could finally feel the cool air outside. I pushed, and Angus continued to make adjustments, squeezing out one ear and then the other until I could see again, and soon enough, my head was through. You're in the world again, Beatrice said and laughed. But didn't you have a tail before? Angus scrambled to the back of me and pulled my tail through the horrifying little hole meant for tails. That's better, he said. It was not better. The sweater was a wretched thing. It scratched me everywhere, like I was enclosed in a thicket of dried weeds. And though I could see, this was not a plus. For now, I knew that about 15 birds and animals were gathered around me. Where had they come from? And many of them were fighting back their laughter. When Angus put the collar on, their barely held laughter escaped in tiny squeaks and sighs. Very dignified, Yolanda said, covering her mouth with her great gray wing. This sweater was a terrible thing for me. I felt very bad, very ashamed, very much like I wanted to be deep in my hollow, alone and in the dark. But then Bertrand did the kind of thing he was known for doing, a wise, rational, convincing, and impossible to debate thing. He brought over a piece of glass. The animals of the park had grown accustomed to glass. We saw it on the buildings, the cars, the windows of the homes that bordered the park. We knew we could see ourselves in the glass, and so our reflections were not foreign to us. We knew what we looked like. For instance, I knew before this day that I was a breathtaking paragon of muscle and speed. And now, when Bertrand brought a piece of glass before me, he'd planned it. I knew I was a ridiculous clown dog, clad in pink and fake diamonds. It will work, Beatrice said. Chapter 18. None of us knew what would happen. Would I actually blend into the world of humans and kept dogs? The sweater covered most of my dappled coloring, disguising me, but I was still the size and shape of the dog they were looking for. Bertrand decided to stick to the original plan, with him flying overhead and keeping track of me and any approaching problems. If he saw vehicles or humans pursuing me in any way, he'd swoop down and let me know. Ready, he asked. I am, I said. He flew up and caught a thermal and floated above me like a guardian cloud. Get going, he yelled down to me. I began. It took the earth under me and sent it into the past. I did it again and again, taking the future and tossing it backward, and soon my eyes were glassy with cold speed, and I was flying. I broke the speed of foxes and rabbits and kept going. I entered the speed of sound and broke it like a cheap toy. When I was flying across the picnic fields and could see the windmill, I could smell the salty ocean. I became light itself. When I slowed down, I realized I'd crossed the highway and was already in the oceanside sand and could feel the surf on my toes. If I hadn't stopped when I think I would have flown across the surface of the sea, I made a note to try that another time, and I smiled. I laughed. I could still run. I looked up and saw Bertrand hovering up near the sun. "So far, so good," he said. "You are wondering about the sweater. You are wondering if the sweater altered my running ability or my ability to reach the speed of light by throwing the future into the past and being the mechanism that turns the world. I am here to tell you that it did not affect this ability, and I have to give credit to whatever human loons had designed and made this garment. For years, I, and every free animal I knew, made glorious fun of these sweaters and looked with pity upon the dogs who wore them. But now that I had run in one, I knew that it did not inhibit my movement. It warmed my body, which I appreciated, especially when I got close to the sea, where the wind often cut through me with sharp, chilled fingers. In all, I was able to run just as well as before, and was warmer than ever. Not bad. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.